Did you hit record? All right. Fly Suit Friday listeners.
We hit record.
it's time. We got it right this time.
Yeah. Nice.
Hey, where are we right now?
Oh, we are still at HAI Helly Expo.
Still at HAI Helly Expo.
Another great day here.
Yeah. Yeah. What fun fact, it's not going to be HAI next year. I think I don't really mention that. Yeah, VAI. And it's going to be Verticon, which sounds sick.
It's okay. Like Decepticon.
Yeah.
Like for vertical lift, too. Yeah. We're trying to incorporate even unmanned aviation, the pilots that fly those.
Yeah. And then unmanned podcast probably to follow.
Careful, it could be better quality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so Kenny, last time we were in California reporting, doing a podcast, we had a pretty good one.
We did.
Yeah, with Captain Tim Eason retired.
Yeah.
And the old Celandang IU.
Yeah. And, yeah, admittedly, we're here at the Heli Expo, and, you know, I'm out by the food trucks, and a gentleman comes up and introduces himself, and I'm like, oh, hey, you know, you're a bunch of people, and then it hit me about 5 minutes that it was Doug Watson, and I was so embarrassed. I still am embarrassed, but, yeah, we found Doug Watson, and that's going to be kind of the sequel to the Tim Eason Celandang IU, and I could not be more excited about it. So,
hey Doug.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Welcome to Flight 2 Friday.
Thanks. I'm really interested in cracking this beer. Can we jump right to
this? Oh my gosh, I love when we do this.
Oh, first beer I need to jump right to that segment, please.
Yeah. Music to my ears. Oh, synchronized.
And for the viewers, we got 3 Voodoo Juice Forces, which are 9.5%, definitely Kenny approved.
Yeah.
and Doug's rocking the classic Silver Bullet over there.
Yeah. I figured if you wanted me coherent 10 minutes into this, you probably need to give me something light.
Just give us the cue when you want to go incoherent. Yeah. I got you. And I'm your bartender.
Because I'm pretty sure we have bourbon over there and we can start slinging that.
Yeah. I'll give you the tap on the head.
Yeah. Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, no problem.
Really excited for this. Can you just tell us a bit about yourself, Coast Guard background, what you're doing now?
Yeah, I was a pilot before I joined the Coast Guard, and I joined up in 1998, so I was already a flight instructor and stuff like that, so I was one of those folks that did pretty well in flight school.
Everyone was jealous.
Yeah, you know, and sorry about that, but
it's okay.
Sorry, but not sorry.
You don't have to apologize.
Yeah. Right? So my experience at flight school was a lot different, I think, but it was a challenge. Yes, it was a challenge. I was lucky enough, and you probably don't want to hear that, but I was lucky enough to get H-60s. First station was Clearwater. So nice. I spent 4 years in Clearwater, then PCS'd up to Kodiak, where this story takes place. I was there for 3 years. Then found myself going to headquarters for a little therapy, possibly, you know, a little therapeutic session after coming out of Kodiak. And then 3 years later, after being at headquarters, I got a Falcon transition, went to Cape Cod, flew the Falcon for 4 years and sort of sunsetted the aircraft out of Cape Cod.
Nice.
Went down to Mobile and then got into the CASA and then spent 5 years down in Mobile. I was like the admin guy for a year, and then I was an assistant trade up for 4 years roughly. So I was not one of the instructors, unfortunately. I missed that.
I was about to say that's a miserable job. Yeah. I'd much rather be an instructor, you know.
Yeah, I will say this about those jobs. You learn a tremendous amount of stuff, right?
You do.
And you really broaden your portfolio.
Yeah.
So I was flying when I was in Mobile, so it wasn't like I gave up the ghost, but I was not I didn't progress past like first pilot. I didn't want to because I had such, you know, a load on my desk every day that there was no way I could really get to that competency level.
You can't really manage it,
I was trying to do my best to stay on the duty rotation with OPDEP, so they were letting me fly. And really,
oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, so I was standing duty and stuff like that whenever I could. Finally it got to that point where it was either, you know, that decision, I'm at 20 years, I've got a PCS, what do I do? And the outside just started looking really, really good. So I got out after that. So now I'm flying for I'm flying corporate.
Nice.
I went to Southern Company. So the guy that I replaced in Mobile at assistant trade up, a guy named Bill Field, he was a Falcon pilot and a branch instructor for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
He was, like I said, in the job of a trade up before I went into that job. Well, he went to Southern Company as a corporate pilot when he retired out of the job. And so I saw a posting on LinkedIn. I said, I know a guy that works there. I sent him an email and he said, dude, give me your resume. We're hiring. And
that nice. Coastie Network. You
yeah,
know,
it is. Coastie Network. Well. Oh, and it is live well here at Heli yeah. Expo, too.
Yeah. So the great thing about this was it was my dream job right out of the gate. Oh, so so I'm flying the Gulfstream 280 and the Sikorsky 76.
Yeah, so you're that's dual sweet. Rated right now.
Yeah, dual rated, yep.
That is really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome. Yeah. Like I said, my dream job. So
how many flight hours are you at right now in total?
Not really that much. Probably about 7,000 or so. 7 or 8,000.
Yeah, that's not a lot.
Well, I mean, I've been flying for 35 years, something like that. So, you know, if I went to the airlines...
Oh, you'd be
15 years
them up.
Ago, yeah, I'd be over 10,000 now.
But then you wouldn't be as happy as you are now. So.
Oh, no, I am so happy.
Yeah.
And this beer is tasting so good.
I know, oh, it man. Really does. I was a little worried about it, but it is tasting really good right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I appreciate that, guys. Yeah, thank you.
Fight through the first 10 minutes of heartburn, and then it's smooth sailing after that.
But so full disclosure, before we go on, I have listened to every single episode of Flight Suit Friday.
Wow.
No right. way.
Yeah, my hero. Well, I wasn't listening to it from the beginning. I sort of, about 8 months ago, somebody told, actually, I think it was last year, I bumped into Nick and he mentioned the podcast. And so over the course of, driving to and from work, I listened to every single episode to get myself caught
up. You're making me blush right now.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to put you on the spot. What's your in-person review?
It's fantastic. I've got so many great things to say. I've been telling people about it. You know, it's such a remarkable culture, such a unique culture of aviation that you have in the Coast Guard that I was happy to be a part of. It's something that I treasure even today, thinking back on all the lessons I've learned about CRM and ORM and all those things that you just sort of learn by happenstance, just because you're in the room when the conversations are happening, right? These conversations don't happen outside of the Coast Guard for the most part. And so I've been introducing fellow helicopter pilots to it, just to listen to the stories and take away the lessons, and because they're universal, right? A lot of these lessons are not only universal to helicopters, but universal to aviation, universal to life. So it's been a, I've been... One after another, I've been like craving the next one. So when you guys went on that hiatus over the Christmas season,
I know
I started getting the shakes. I was getting the shakes. It was terrible. It's like withdrawal.
Dang. Well, we got some good ones coming. I hope you listen to your own too. So
Well, you never want to hear your own voice.
It is
right?
It's same here. Miserable.
Since we started doing it, like. Listen to a couple episodes, but after a while you're like, oh, my voice sounds terrible.
I sound like a hamster.
They're all laughing at me.
That's not me.
Doug, you said you were flying before the Coast Guard. Was there like a certain moment that like made you draw towards aviation? What started that journey for you?
I don't even remember. Four years old, 5 years old, something like that. It's all I've ever known that I wanted to do. And it came out of nowhere. Nobody in my family or friends or anything like that of the family, nobody was in aviation. So I don't know where it came from.
Yeah. I feel like every little kid at some point like wants to be a pilot. It sounds like you just never grew up. You always instilled in you.
That's funny. I don't think any of us has ever grown up, but like that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
I struggle now. My son, he's in high school. He's a junior and he's thinking about what he wants to do for a career path, and he's going back and forth, and I can't relate to that, because ever since I was little, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. It was just the choosing the right path to get there. That was the choice, right? So the Coast Guard was I was fortunate enough. One day I was working up in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. I was flight instructing at the time. I was working like 3 or 4 different jobs just trying to make ends meet. Living paycheck to paycheck. And then Coast Guard H-60 landed on the ramp one day. And it was Tom Main, who retired as a captain out of ATC, CO of ATC. He got out as a lieutenant. And I went out and introduced myself. And he said, we're dying for pilots. Here's my card. Give me a call. And he really was the main driver of me getting into the Coast Guard.
So, that's awesome. That's really cool. What? So just really quick. You were a flight instructor in what kind of aircraft prior to the
single Coast Guard? Single engine, multi-engine airplanes.
Okay, sweet. Awesome. Yep. Very cool. CFI, CFII?
Yep. Yes. Actually, at that time, I wasn't an MEI. I was a CFI, double I. Yep.
So, yeah, flight school was easy for you.
No, it wasn't easy. It was challenging. Yeah. But, a lot of this, people ask, did you learn a lot? Yes, I learned a lot. I learned about the Navy way of flying, which is different than the civilian way of flying. And so I had to unlearn a lot of things, and that was the most challenging aspect of Navy flight school, was unlearning those lessons that I had been teaching kids, you know, so I had really reinforced a lot of those lessons in my own brain.
Single pilot, resource management.
Yeah, yeah, right. A lot of that stuff. I remember when I got to flight school, just a quick story. Yeah. In the T-34, that's what we were flying at the time. I had, I think it was one of my first FAMs. So it's, maybe the second or third flight, something like that. In my helmet bag, I had a sectional chart. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps instructor at the time, he saw that sectional chart in my bag and he made me throw it in the garbage. He yelled at me. He made me throw it in the garbage. He said, "We did not train you to use that chart yet. Throw it away." So I had, I had to chuck it.
You didn't say, "Hey, bud."
No. You didn't. Yeah, I didn't want to go there.
Smart move.
Lay low as best you can. Just go with the flow.
Which is like the biggest rule of flight school is to just argue with, like, roger that. Out the door it goes.
Yeah. This thing, I don't even, it was just look cool. I don't even know what it is.
It's wrapping paper.
Yeah, exactly.
Which also is my favorite Flight Suit Friday tip. Sectionals make for great wrapping paper for Christmas time.
We'll remember that next Christmas.
Family loves it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sweet.
Do they still print those?
I usually just like scoop up ones that are getting thrown out or anything and I just like collect them and I'll just wrap them in there.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Anyways, Flight Suit Friday, hot tip.
Yeah. So let's jump into it.
Sure.
Yeah. Selendang IU, like I don't know where we want to start the stage here, but the floor is yours.
I don't want to rehash a lot of the stuff that Tim went over.
It's because soup to nuts. Give us it. I mean, it's a different perspective. So
How did the day start? What led up to it?
He kind of told us where his story started was the initial call and the distress and how they were on the back of the boat and they were listening to you guys.
Right.
So we haven't heard that side from you guys getting the call and launching and going out there and obviously the weather planning because it was pretty shit weather.
Yep. Yeah, it was. So there were two helicopters in Cold Bay the morning of the mishap, morning of the Selendang IU grounding. The 6020, we had arrived on a C-130. We were actually supposed to be going out to St. Paul Island for a avdet for about 2 weeks of time. And so we were diverted in the C-130. We landed in Cold Bay and we were told, stand by here, there may be something going on for you. An aircraft arrived and then in the middle of the night, another aircraft, another 60 arrived. So we actually had, when we woke up in the morning on the 8th, we had two aircraft and we were in Cold Bay. There were actually three flight crews there at the time. So we took one of the aircraft and we moved forward up to Dutch Harbor. And then we went to breakfast because they said, just move forward, get closer to the situation. We don't know what's going on yet, but we want you to be ready to go in case, you know, we need you for something. So at that point, we didn't really have a mission. We were just being ready for, standby to standby type of deal. So the other aircraft actually were about an hour behind us. They landed in Dutch Harbor and we met them out for food. And then we got basically called to go out to scene. And originally, you know, so this is one of the things that Tim's talked about and I'll just highlight this. This is an overarching theme. The situation, the mission changed a number of times, right? And so keeping up with the changes was very, very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Because minute by minute, things were evolving.
Yeah,
right?
Because how many assets were being moved to the scene as well? Like that is a lot of coordination too.
Yeah, it is. So we had the Coast Guard cutter, we had a C-130 in the area, we had two H-60 helicopters, we had the H-65 on the back of the cutter. Then there were tugboats, all sorts of stuff that was moving to the scene. And this is a huge, you know, if you look back at the case study for this event, it is a big Coast Guard story.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the fact that there was an aviation mishap is really just sort of a small item in the overall big mishap of the ship and the environmental catastrophe, if, you know, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, just like the cross-pollination of all the communities like prevention and response and, you know, get the pollution out and the aviation and the cutter and,
In each different, and I've noticed this throughout all SAR cases, big or small, each different response of different assets change the way you respond as your individual crew. So you kind of have to, like, predict the way that somebody else is going to respond a little bit to kind of plan how your response is going to look. And that changes. It's so dynamic.
Yep. That's right. That's right. And this was no different to that. One thing I remember about being in Coast Guard Aviation is you never really understood how many people were at the other end of the phone, right? So when you got a call from sector, from district, you didn't realize, you know, you were talking to one person, you're trying to get the details from one person, but there's a huge number of people that are behind that call. Yeah. whether it's informants, people that are calling in the, you know, the distress, or the people that are coordinating all the assets, all that stuff. So, you know, you see your little piece of the puzzle, but you don't really understand all the other pieces and how they fit together. Anyway, I digress from that. But that morning in Dutch Harbor, we took off and the weather was really kind of skosh. It was one of these days where 1 second it was a quarter mile and blowing snow and 60 knots of wind, 40 foot seas. And then all of a sudden that squall would move through. And the next minute it would be sort of mostly, you know, partly clear skies with the winds would lay down. And then 2 minutes later, another squall would move through and make it miserable again. So that was happening all day long.
It's a trap.
It is a trap.
Admiral Akbar right there, Star Wars. It's a trap.
Yep. Yeah, a day full of sucker holes, basically, is what it boiled down to. So we happened to take off out of Dutch Harbor in one of those times when it was about a quarter mile and blowing snow. And we took off, and, you're flying IMC and VFR conditions, you know, whatever.
That's disorienting,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it is. And this was the J model, so it's a lot of its radar navigation. The great thing about flying the Jayhawk and learning how to fly the radar is now I'm teaching guys how to use the radar instead of just putting it in auto mode.
Yeah.
It's like I actually know, how to tune it and how to, so I can navigate with it apparently. So I was flying in the right seat. Dave Neal, who was he was actually the aircraft commander. He was sitting in the left seat. That was a typical thing. I would imagine it still is, where the aircraft commander is sitting in the left seat, the co-pilot sitting in the right seat. And the idea is, any monkey can hoist, right? It's the mission management.
Yeah,
that's the hard part. That's where the seasoned veteran comes in, right? So that was pretty traditional up there. We were both aircraft commanders, obviously, to get up to Kodiak. You had to be an AC, but he was more senior to me, and so he was AC for that flight. Anyway, so we got around to the scene, and we went from not knowing what we were going to do to all of a sudden now we have to fly over to the Alex Haley, pick up survival suits, take them to the crew members of the Selendang IU. That was the first real instruction that we got. However, even before we got on scene with the Alex Haley, they changed that. And what was happening was that the Selendang IU was still floating. It was dragging an anchor. And the ship's captain reported that they wanted to try and put another anchor down, right? The Alex Haley had already given up efforts to tow it. They had tried and failed, as probably Tim mentioned that.
Yep.
And so the Alex Haley was now trying to get the captain of the Selendang IU to start releasing people off the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And the captain finally agreed. So instead of now dropping off survival suits to those folks on board, because at the time, they didn't have to have enough survival suits. I think they only had like two on board. It wasn't a requirement.
That's crazy.
Since our mishap, it's now a international requirement that. So
okay.
We changed international maritime policy. Anyway, so when we arrived, like I said, we shifted to now we're starting to recover people. So this boat, 800 feet long or whatever it was, and really narrow on the beam, was kind of beamed to the sea. It was dragging one anchor, so it wasn't probably even dragging. Maybe the anchor broke or something like that. You couldn't see. And it was beamed to the sea, so it was rolling really fast, back and forth. And we're flying along this boat, and I'm trying to do a high recon and try and figure out where to hoist from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I have absolutely no idea, because the whole boat is moving way more than this size boat should be moving. But again, it was beamed to the sea, so it was rolling. It wasn't really pitching at all. But fortunately, they got the port side anchor, I believe, in the water, and it grabbed. And so all of a sudden now the bow turned into the wind and seas. And so now it became a pitching exercise. When it was still rolling, though, before it actually got, sort of set in position a little bit, I found a place just after the forecastle. I don't know what a forecastle is, but I have heard that word before, so I'm just going to use it.
But you knew you were going to hoist right behind it.
The other word I know is fantail.
I thought it was foxhole. Anyway,
fantail and starburst.
Or folksile.
Starboard.
A folksile.
So
just, after of the forecastle on the port side of the boat. It's a boat, not a ship. Yeah. No, it's a boat. So we found that area, and the reason I picked that, because along the center line of the boat, if the boat's rolling, you want to find something that's along the center line, right? Because what you're worried about, or at least what I was worried about, was the up and down movement of the deck, right? And so I wanted to minimize up and down. So the way to do that is along the center line of the boat, right? So however, in this boat, there were like four or five big cranes along the center line. So there was no place there. So I found this place on the port side of the forecastle. It was kind of a big, relatively large hoisting area. It wasn't really confined at all, but it seemed to be moving the least.
Yeah.
And so that's where I sort of set up. And from there, it took about an hour until the boat captain actually started releasing people. But during that time, they were able to get the port side anchored in the water and it started holding. And so the boat eventually turned into the wind and seas. So here I am. So now I've sort of positioned myself. And this is, you know, this is probably planned continuation bias. When we do these trainings, we go around to different air stations or we have over the last 20 years. One thing I talk about as a lesson learned is planned continuation bias, where you have a plan A and then you become so fixated that you forget about planning a backup plan, right? Yeah. So that was our plan, was that one hoisting location. Even though the boat turned into the wind now, so the conditions had changed.
Yeah.
And now the bow was rising and falling, right? So if I had probably moved back on the boat, maybe I could have minimized the up and down motion, but it took an hour to get people 600 or 800 feet to that point to get hoisted. So we didn't want to change the plan as everybody's moving forward to that point. You know, if we change location, then everybody, you know, would just waste more time, right?
Yep.
So we're like, let's just stay here and just deal with it.
Real quick question.
Go ahead.
Was the weather doing the same thing that it was? And
Yeah, it was.
So I could appreciate the fixation, though, because
you're
sitting there like you don't have a horizon to look at. You're looking at this boat that's pitching, and that doesn't help.
No, right. Like I said, though, every once in a while, it would be clear sky, beautiful visibility, and the seas and winds. You know, so we had time to do that. But one interesting thing about the day is you'd see the snow squall approaching, right? And Dave Neal in the left seat, he'd warn me about it. And he'd say, you know, he'd tell me when the waves, the sets were coming in. And so I'd do one hoist, and he'd say, okay, back off. There's a set rolling through. So I'd back off, and then he'd say, you know, we'd watch the boat move a lot or whatever, and the set would be over, and then I could move back in. And so it's almost like when you saw this quarter mile snow, you know, visibility snowstorm approaching, it gave us enough time to sort of move out of the way, let the boat move around, and then I could move back
into it.
Use
that as a reference.
Right. So Dave was doing that all day long. He was counting, you know, basically counting the swells as they were coming towards us and sort of helping me see that, because, you know, obviously when you're hoisting, you're more focused on what's down below, So, and it was a very challenging hoist. So tunnel vision was very strong that day, just because it took a lot of concentration and effort just to stay over position of the boat. So we got the first group off. I believe that was, let's see, if my math is correct. I think that was first group of nine. And, you know, of course, it was the classic, you put the basket down and somebody just puts their suitcase in it and then stands back. You know, that happened a few times.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and it's also, I think I've heard this on other podcasts too, where one of the things you sort of have to consider, even though it's not really a necessity for you, is you also have to make sure, like passports, you know, people have identification because you're going to be landing back at a U.S. port.
Yeah.
It's a foreign crew.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not life or death right there. But at the same time, so we had to send the navigator with the passports and stuff like that. And so that all took time to get all that done. But we got the first group of nine off. And that's really where the fun began, because the direction we were given at that point was take them over to the Alex Haley, because the Alex Haley was right there.
Yeah.
And in our mind, we were thinking we're going to go drop off that first group of nine. The other helicopter, the other H-60, which was the 6021, they were going to come back on. They were just arriving on scene as we were finishing up.
Mm-hmm.
So they waited for us for a few minutes. So we got over to the Alex Haley, and they were picking up the next group of nine. And so we were thinking, once we drop off this first group, we'll just go back and get the remaining folks off the boat, and we'll be done lickety-split.
Yeah.
Right? So the hoisting to the Alex Haley, though, that was the real challenging thing. And you know, again, it's a large boat. You're used to hoisting. At the time, we were hoisting the 41-footers. 47s had just come online.
Yeah.
So you're used to what you would consider to be a much more challenging platform. But when you see a boat even as big as the Alex Haley with a large flight deck moving around as much as it does, you know, in my mind, because even though I had been to Advanced Rescue Swimmer School, ARS at the time, right? Even though I'd been to that school before, figuring out how to hoist to a boat, a flight deck that is moving that much. I had not only never tried it myself, yeah. but I had never even heard of anybody telling me, you know, those stories, those wardroom stories that we often rely on for good information yeah. and good ideas.
Yeah.
I didn't even have that in my, in yeah. my gas tank to, yeah. To draw back on. Right. So at that point I'm kind of like just making it up.
Right.
Right. And there's some video that I've seen online of this. And actually, there was a PA on board the Alex Haley that was videotaping uh-huh. my attempts at hoisting. And the first videos are abysmal. They are terrible. And what had happened is I was, you know, this is all in hindsight. What I had figured out is I was kind of spotting the deck, right? So when the flight deck would go up, and uh-huh. we're talking, you know, probably 20, 30 feet of rise or whatever.
Oh my
gosh. The seas were about 35 feet or so.
That's shocking to me because like my ideal hoisting altitude off of a boat is 35 feet, 30 feet.
You'd be getting smacked by that flight deck nonstop.
That is such a massive oscillation yep. of such a large flat area.
Right. So, you know, in hindsight being 2020, I've learned so many things that could have helped me that day, yeah. right? Throughout the course of the day. But it wasn't until after all this stuff had happened that I started learning. And I'm like, that would have been great information to have in the manual.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it wasn't there at the time. So I was just trying to make it up and trying to get through it.
Out of curiosity, were you shipboard qualified?
No, I was
okay.
not.
Okay. Because I think kind of what we're talking about, you know, being a shipboard guy, you're really like looking at the horizon, because if you look at that deck and that's what you watch, you're going to do exactly probably what happened to you, which was you follow that boat and you kind of naturally just start flying form with that, because yeah. that's kind of what we naturally do.
That's
exactly,
I mean, that's what I would have. I've never landed on a ship, yeah. and that's exactly what I would have.
And like you, you know, just like you were saying, you hear people like, oh, yeah, 40, 41, or, you know, 47, you know, no problem. And because that's what we did, and we kind of knew it. And then, you know, you hear about someone being like, oh, actually, they had to cancel. We're going to go hoist with an 87 this afternoon. And someone's like, oh, great, easy. Until you see that mast start swinging 40 yeah. feet. You know, the boat's only doing a 10-degree roll, but that mast, and,
yeah,
dude, it is...
it's unsettling.
It's unsettling, and it messes with your internal gyro when you see this thing swinging back and forth. So,
yeah. And unfortunately, you know, if you don't have the experience... or even the knowledge, you know, let alone the experience, in order to deal with that, you're kind of left to your own sure. devices yeah. to figure yeah. out. And I love where the CRM program and the ORM program and the Coast Guard has gone since this event happened, because it really sort of, it got so much more mature, especially ORM, very quickly, right?
Yeah.
So we knew what ORM was. Mm-hmm. We knew that we could refuse a case if we thought it was too dangerous. We knew these things, but ORM wasn't really in our vernacular. There was a manual that existed that explained it, but maybe one person, maybe the CO read it, you know, something yes. like that.
It was a box that was checked.
Yeah, exactly, right. So down at the hangar level or down in the wardroom level, it wasn't really in our vernacular.
Yeah.
We didn't have a risk assessment tool. We didn't have all these things. It was just kind of like, well, let's go stick our nose into it. And
yeah.
if it's too dangerous, we know we can say no, and we know we can stop what we're yeah. doing. But that's as far as ORM yeah. went, right?
So flight mechs and swimmers love it when you say, when they hear pilots say, we'll just stick our nose into it.
Yeah, yeah. right.
Nobody wants to be the person that says like, oh, this is too dangerous. It's like, no, I'll keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You good?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of Coast Guard business, important business, life-saving business gets done that way too.
Yep.
So we can't just sit back and say, you
can't
know,
turn everything down.
Don't ever say, don't stick, you know, I'll yeah. stick my nose yeah. into it, because a lot of good things in history have happened because yeah. you were willing to at least explore the option of whether or not to do
I
it.
I feel
right?
like initially we overcorrected, and that yep. was a negative term. And now we're on this, we're correcting back to a really nice, like, hey, like, we have the ability to go and recon,
right,
and then say no when it gets too dangerous. So
yeah,
and I feel like that's a great place to be, instead of being like, you know, the whole like stick your nose in it, which yes, it's probably not great to say that all the time, but
yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, that the plan continuation bias,
yeah.
right? So
yes.
So to prevent that trap is to, when you initially formulate a plan, is to come up with a plan B.
Yeah.
So that way it's easy to flip the switch from plan A to plan B.
Yeah.
if you only have a plan A, you are only going to do a plan A. And then because it's too hard to come up with a plan B.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
You try to force it.
And set decision gates and things like that. You put those in place. Yeah. I think that's the good correction that we're making back towards you.
Yeah, and that's great. That's really good to hear. Yeah. I like to think that we were started somewhat of the impetus for a lot of that that stuff. So it makes me feel good to hear it in a couple different ways.
Yeah.
So, so the Alex Haley, my biggest concern, as I mentioned, was the boat was moving, the flight deck was moving vertically up and down 20, 30 feet.
Yeah.
And at such a rate that I had no idea. I didn't remember the numbers for how fast the hoist cable moved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. Normally when you're hoisting, you're pulling people off the deck of a boat, right? We're putting people down on the deck of the boat.
I was
thinking
that earlier.
Yeah.
We don't train for that.
Right. We don't. Right. And so my problem is this, you can yank somebody off a boat in a basket if you do it real quick, you wait, and probably they'll be fine.
Yeah.
Right. for the most part. But if you're putting somebody down on the boat, in my mind, I'm thinking, how is the flight mech going to adjust over the top of a moving object, if he looks down, he's seeing the deck move up and down. He really doesn't have a very good perception of where the basket is in relation, especially if the deck is moving quickly.
Yeah.
So in my mind, I'm thinking, I've got to come up with a way to minimize the amount of vertical up and down underneath the aircraft. And the only way I could think of doing that was to, try and fly formation on the flight deck, right? So originally, like I said, I was spotting the deck. I was completely out of sync with the boat because I was waiting until I saw the flight deck move up before I pulled collective in order to start, right? So I was getting out of phase. What I eventually figured out was if I moved my scan to the bridge wing of the ship, so I don't know what that is on the Alex Haley, but, say 200 feet forward of that.
Yeah.
And when the bridge wing moved, that's when I would pull collective or lower collective. So I was flying the bridge wing, as I was over the flight deck. And actually, that put me in sync with the boat. So that sort of accounted for the human reaction, the movement of the muscles and stuff like that. And so I was able to adjust that way. And actually, after that, the hoisting went fine. It was just that learning how to do something you've never heard of or never done yourself and trying to make it as safe and expeditious as possible, right? So,
I mean, that was you going through like the CRM, ORM cycle in your head of like, how's this going?
Yeah.
Not good. Okay. Yep. How do I make it better? I don't know. Oh, let me try. Oh, how'd that one go?
Yeah.
Well, a lot better,
Dave Neal at one point, he said, you look like a monkey.
Yeah, baby.
For football.
He's like, I feel like it too.
Yeah, that's exactly what I told him.
Like, that's spot on.
Yep. Yeah. I draw a lot of light to myself, a lot of the spotlight to myself with things that I've learned that I should have done better, right? So I'm, here we are 20 years later almost, and I have spent a lot of time thinking and talking through this, and I try to be as candid about it as possible to give the best educational benefit to other people. And one thing I could tell you I did poorly that day was I was not a very good communicator. I was so focused on what I was doing. I didn't tell Dave what I was trying to do. So he had no idea. Mm-hmm. So when he made a comment like that, that was his way of saying, what are you doing?
Yeah. That task saturation though,
you didn't have the bandwidth to open your mouth or try to figure out the words to communicate what was happening,
That is a crazy thing when you are so task saturated with flying the aircraft that saying simple words just is so difficult.
Well, one thing kind of like that episode we did with Chuck Aaron where you talked about being a pilot monitoring, learning the art of like, how do I get him to crack out of this?
Yeah, right.
Or him or her, just tell that, work the pilot because you could tell when a pilot's getting overloaded.
And you can't be too abrasive to throw them off their game. You have to just talk.
You got to have some good bedside manner.
It's almost like you have to be like a part-time psychologist, therapist, in order to work it out. Work
some R&B music.
Exactly.
Let's work this.
If they made the seats a little bit more comfortable, you could sort of recline
a little massager.
These plastic Adirondack chairs.
Yeah, exactly. I keep feeling like I'm sliding out of this thing.
Yeah. No, you just look comfortable.
I'm comfortable. This beer is helping. I appreciate that. So we got those folks down on the Alex Haley, and somebody, I think it was the captain of the boat at the time, as the next 60 was coming in, the 6021 was coming in to drop off the next 9 people, they reached an agreement that we are not doing that again. The captain of the Alex Haley had watched me really make a mess of hoisting, and they realized, it's too dangerous to do this. So then the tasking became 6021, go back to Dutch Harbor and drop off your nine folks.
Okay.
All right, so we were on scene at about an hour before they were, so we had less fuel than they did, right? So here's a good idea for, you know, at least we thought so. 6021, you stay on scene. Let's do a beach transfer. Get your folks onto our helicopter. We'll fly back to Dutch Harbor. We'll get gas. You stay on scene for an extra hour, and that way we minimize the gap between aircraft coverage.
Yeah.
Right? That's, so again, the plan is changing. It's very dynamic, and so that becomes the plan as we know it.
Yeah.
We try to do a beach transfer of the nine folks. We find this one place, and as we're sort of setting up for an approach, there was a downdraft. It almost put us into the ground.
Wow.
So we found another place. You know, maybe it's not so good here. So we found another spot. We did a beach transfer of the folks. We, you know, as we decided, we took them back to Dutch Harbor. And we thought the 6021 was going to be on scene for about another hour or so. At some point, though, they were RTBing back to Cold Bay. They were told to go to Cold Bay. So we didn't know that plan had changed again. So they disappeared to go back to Cold Bay. We were back in Dutch Harbor. And the boat at that point was expecting us to come back to pick up the remaining eight people, but they didn't know where we went, right? Okay. So.
And how's comms happening right now? Like, air to air with the other 60, pretty good. Are you talking to sector for like tasking? I don't know how good radio comms are out.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll be honest with you. Here's another confession. Radio comms are terrible when you turn off all your radios on the pilot side, so you don't have to listen to anything.
Gosh,
right?
It's so that's sometimes my favorite thing. Like, you know what? Screw it. You handle it. I'm gonna hoist.
Yeah, exactly.
All the pins are going down.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what I did. But what I think was going on. So we had in the back of the aircraft, we had Brian Lickfield, who was a seasoned flight mech. We had Aaron Bean, who was a very unseasoned rescue swimmer. But so we had HF comms through our rescue swimmer in the back. We were talking to the boat. They were sort of holding our comms guard.
Okay.
We had a C-130 overhead for a long period of time. They were, you know, so we were able, we had plenty of communications.
Okay.
I don't think we were directly talking to district, but district obviously was running the show from Anchorage, you know, 1,000 miles away, right? So, so there was a communication network of which I was not privy in the front right seat because I had everything turned off, right?
Amazing.
Yeah. But that's how much I needed to focus and just the constant stream of radio communications between the ships, you know, between the four ships on scene, between the aircraft flying around and stuff like that. It was just too much. So I just deselected everything.
Yeah.
So we did the beach transfer. We went back to Dutch Harbor. The other 60 went back to Cold Bay shortly after. And then on the way, the 6021, here's another thing we didn't know. The 6021 got a chip light. I think a main transmission chip light.
Something like that had to happen.
Yeah, exactly, right? So Murphy's Law was definitely present that day.
Yeah.
So they get a main chip. They land in Cold Bay, and they are done because I think it was actually making metal.
Yeah.
You know, fast forward 3 weeks later, they just finished the main transmission change in the hangar in Cold Bay, Alaska, in the middle of the winter, right? Yeah. So they were halfway there, I think, when they got the chip light. And so they're flying, you know, here's a great AC board question, you know. You're halfway to nowhere, you know, and you get a main transmission chip light or something, you know, possibly a catastrophic failure. You don't really know it's just a symptom, right? A symptom of potentially a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. You don't really know.
Right.
You know. So what do? Do you land and put your entire crew into a survival situation? You know, possibly.
In Alaska.
In the middle of a winter storm, you know, in an uninhabited island that, you know, it is a survival situation if you land the aircraft there. There are, you know, there aren't airports, villages or nothing.
Yeah.
You are in the wilderness and in the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah.
Do you do that or do you press on and try and get back to the airfield at Cold Bay, you know? And so ultimately, they made the right call because they got back to Cold Bay. Everybody was fine. The aircraft, though, was down for a while.
Is it similar? Because in the 65, if we get a main gearbox chip light, it's to, you know, it's basically says maintain minimum, you know, safe airspeed and altitude and prepare for a loss of, you know, your main gearbox and a land ditch immediately. Is it kind of the same thing?
I believe so.
Like, it's not a land ditch quite, but if you get one more thing, you're going to be
like
ditching.
A dynamic. Yeah. If you get a dynamic condition, then it's like,
That's a tough choice.
Yeah.
I mean, right.
this day and age, I think we have flares and, you know, metal and magnesium that'll burn, like, sorry, Coast Guard. But
big old bonfire.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's tough.
Yeah, right. So we didn't know that was going on.
Yeah.
What we were expecting was that the 6021 was still on scene. Mm-hmm. So we dropped off all our stuff. We called back to the ODO. So now we're on deck in Dutch Harbor. Mm-hmm. Now our communication chain has changed. Now we're talking to the air station back in Kodiak, mm-hmm. which again is, you know, 500 miles away yeah. or something.
And how
like
far
that.
Is Dutch from the incident again, roughly?
It's about a 40-minute flight.
Okay.
We had to go, you know, straight line distance. It wasn't that far, but we had to go around the Makuchin volcano.
Okay.
So it was about 40 minutes of transit yeah. out to the scene to get around the island because mm-hmm. you couldn't fly over it.
Yeah. Okay.
So when we got to Dutch Harbor, we got the aircraft fueled, and we got word through the ODO that we were stood down, that the captain said he had everything under control, and that we weren't going to be needed for a while. So they said, stay there in Dutch Harbor, get the aircraft ready to go in case we need you. But for right now, go have fun at the Grand Aleutian, get yeah. your seafood buffet.
Yep.
And
all you can eat shrimp.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And just keep your, you know, we had a cell phone at the time. Cell phones weren't really a big thing at the time, but we got one. We borrowed one from the MSU that was there in Dutch Harbor, nice. And we had a pickup truck. And so,
dude, cell phone and a pickup truck. That's all you need in Alaska. Yeah. I mean.
Right.
Little game of snake.
So we took about another hour or so getting the aircraft refueled because we had to wait on the fuel truck, you know. And we thought we were done. We thought we were just sort of in a limbo status. But we got into we restarted the aircraft, put the pump back on, got everything back. We got a call. Basically, we got into the pickup truck to drive to the Grand Aleutian, and the phone was ringing. And it was the air station saying, where are you guys? You guys need to get out there right now. And we're like, oh, man. So right there is kind of a pivotal moment, right? Because you were stood down.
Yeah.
Right? And so your mind, you know, you have that adrenaline driving yep. you for
and
so
you
long.
It. Yeah.
I dumped it, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to reignite that fire. That's
yeah. So there was a conversation tough. That so Dave and I were in the, you know, so the guys were outside with the aircraft. Dave and I were inside the terminal there in Dutch Harbor, and he was on the phone with the ops boss at the time. And after he hung up the phone, he said, "They want us to go back out. Are you good? You know, can you go back out?" And I said, "I really don't want to, but I can." He was like, yeah. "All right." And so we asked the crew, are you guys able to go back out? And they said, yeah, we can do it. So we all jumped back in the helicopter, flew back onto scene. You know, I often get the question at this point, were you flying or did you let Dave fly? Why didn't you transfer controls? And the reason was because by that point, everything had become sort of like a worn glove, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We were in a rhythm.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to mix up that rhythm. Yeah,
slip if Dave, right back into it.
Yeah, if Dave got into the right seat, he would have to relearn all the stuff that I already learned.
You're
you know?
Essentially warmed up and you learned your lessons. And yeah.
Right. So even though I worked my ass off, you know, for the first, and we're not talking a lot of time. This is only a couple hours, yeah. you know. But even though I worked myself really, you know, really hard for those couple of hours, I was able to get back up onto that level where I didn't feel tired at all, you yeah. know, and so I was still ready to go. Nice. I didn't have any qualms about going yeah. back out other than it sucked. I really don't want to go back
but
out.
But, like, yeah. I think that's a good distinction to make is you may feel good, but it doesn't mean you didn't work really hard, and there's no way that you're as good as you were on that first sortie,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah, right,
I definitely
right.
think there's, like, you're like, oh, I feel great. And you're like, yeah, but you're not as good as you were regardless of how you feel.
Yeah,
about,
right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, and that's... Yes, you're exactly right, and that's always something I guess to keep in mind is
because we
never,
all
you're
we
never
all do that, right?
You
you're like, hey, we good to go back out? Yeah, I'm good. I feel great. And you're like, well, yeah. science says you're not great. You know, like you got 2 hours of sleep, or you yeah. were, you know, working really hard to the point where you needed to turn radios down, and you know, you were learning new aviation skills on the fly in a high stress situation with lives on the line.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah right,
so, yeah, yeah.
So getting your mind back into that mode, you know, when you've already been stood down was challenging.
You're dragging anchor.
Yeah, like. Dragging anchor, right? but on that day, for some reason, we were able to get, once you start, you know, getting underway and you're actually flying
oh, yeah.
again,
yeah.
you start getting back into the mindset and, yep. and you're easily able to throw the switch again and get yep. back into, you know, put your game face back on.
You know what
like
always
that.
Helps is turning the aircraft on and pushing buttons and yep. throwing switches. Like that's your kind
climbing
of
climbing in the seat is the toughest.
Yeah.
It's, yes, it's, exactly.
Once, yeah. once yeah. things get going, you're like, okay, I'm yeah, back.
Exactly. Yep. And the weather wasn't any better.
Yeah.
It wasn't really worse. It was absolutely about the same. So the conditions hadn't really changed, but what did change when we got back out on scene was that the vessel, the Celandang IU, had run aground. So stern first, so bow pointing into the waves in the sea, so away from shore. The stern was on a shoal. So it wasn't on the beach, but it was on yeah. a shoal offshore. So it was aground. Yeah. And so at that point, the captain's like, we've tried everything we can. And I always try and make a point of saying when I'm telling the story that the captain and the crew did heroic things that
yeah.
day.
Oh, of course.
If you read the report from the NTSB, they were working their butts off trying to save this, you know, get the engine started and keep this vessel afloat. They didn't just give up the ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we took off 18 folks from the vessel already, but those were only the 18 folks that they could allow to get off. There were still a contingent of 8 people on board the ship that could not get off because they were fighting until the very end.
Yeah.
They're, you know, the engineering crews and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And one was a guy that was like a, not a sea cadet, but maybe more like an intern of some sort, an apprentice maybe. And he volunteered to stay behind to help, right? So this crew was doing everything they could, but when the vessel finally ran aground, the captain's like, that's it.
Yeah.
The game's over. Yeah. Everybody off.
Yeah, good call from the captain too.
Yeah.
Yep. So that was one thing that changed was the condition of the vessel and the captain's willingness to release the final group of 8. When we had left scene before, the captain was saying, no, I need to keep people on, you know, to keep trying to save yeah. the boat. I need to keep people on. Although at one point we heard an exchange between the Alex Haley and the ship captain. And the Alex Haley said something like, okay, you've got your anchor in the water, but we see, according to our technology, we see that you're still moving back uh-huh. towards land. You know, is your anchor dragging? And the Celandang IU captain said, yeah, we're showing the same thing, but I think our anchor's okay. I don't think we're dragging. You know, it's like, yeah, you know.
One of those is true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Are you sure?
Well, by the time we got back out, it actually ran aground and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that changed was as we were coming around the Makushan volcano, we started hearing crackled radio transmissions that were coming from on scene. And then I'm like, I think I just heard 6-5 something something. I'm like, who are they? You know, where are they? And Dave and I were like, because we didn't.
Oh, that's cute. A little 65 wants to show
up. But we had forgotten totally about it. It was inside the hangar on the deck. The reason that one of the reasons that the hoisting was so challenging was because the hangar had been telescoped out. You know, so the aircraft was inside the hangar. So yeah. we never saw it. Right. Yeah. So I was like, what are they doing out here?
65.
Yeah. Like, where did they come from? You know,
bring your kid to work day.
It shows you how little, you know, we were so focused on our little one piece of the puzzle that we had really no sight of mm-hmm. what else was going on in the world at that mm-hmm. time. Right. So then we heard 6513 and we heard them calling for a green deck or whatever it is you guys do. Then we heard green deck and we heard them taking off just as we're arriving on scene. So one of the many fortuitous moments of the day was the fact that they actually got off the deck. And if you see the video of the takeoff.
It sounds like it wasn't a green deck.
It was a wink, wink, green deck.
Yeah, it was like a green deck?
Yeah. You know, I don't even know if they said green deck, but we heard them taking off. Yeah.
And they're like, what are they doing?
Yeah. That was my favorite part about Tim's story is like, I think they were talking about like, this is going to be sporty. And he's like,
non-standard.
And they use the word sporty or like non-standard, but he really never knew like how non-standard or sporty the takeoff was actually going to be.
Yeah.
I can appreciate that. Like they knew that if they could take off, they didn't necessarily have to land back to it.
And he talked about that.
Yeah. Yep. So I think they were getting off at that point. But the reason they had taken off was because they didn't know where any of the, they didn't know where we were. Because we were within comms of the cutter. You know, we were on a cell phone talking to the air station. Excuse me. So they didn't know where the 6021 was. You know, they had this almost, a PEL situation, mm-hmm. but they were at least making it back to Cold Bay. So it's like, well, they're the only game in town now. But that's what the Alex Haley was at least thinking.
Yeah.
So when we came back on, we were surprised that they had just taken off. Now, if this is where Tim says that we were going pretty much no matter what. Once we got the aircraft spotted on deck and the rotors turning, they were sort of committed at that point.
Yeah.
To get off the boat.
Because he was saying you couldn't turn it off and slow the rotor speed because it would cause massive damage to the aircraft with how much it was moving.
Right. So we at the time, we were thinking, you know, if we got on scene, you know, 15, 30 seconds earlier, they would have heard us calling on the radio. You know, maybe that would have prevented them from taking off.
Yeah.
According to Tim, they were committed still even before they took off. But, you know, who knows? You know, who knows? So we may not have had that backup of the 65.
Right.
But we had a conversation when we got in range. We had a conversation about, you know, who do you want to do this hoist? There's 8 people on board. The 60, we could do it all with one, you know, one aircraft. We sort of deferred to them. They were first on scene. And they said, no, go ahead. You guys can do it. So in hindsight, you know, thanks a lot, Tim.
Yeah.
So we pulled up into the same place that we had been hoisting before. And here again, you know, we're sort of fixated on the original plan. Even though the situation has drastically changed, the conditions have changed, only because now the boat is, you know, it's aground, but it's in a break zone, basically.
Did that change the roll characteristics?
Yeah.
Pretty drastically?
Yeah, at this point, it's pretty much all pitch.
Yeah.
It's not really rolling. It's bow into the sea at this point. So it's just riding up and down. But the period and the steepness of the waves changed, right? Because now it's a break zone as opposed to these rolling swells. Now they're breaking waves. And so that causes the boat to ride different. So if you sort of consider like the stern of the boat was probably anchored pretty well into the ground, into the shoal. And so it was just the bow riding up and down at this point. The anchor obviously wasn't doing anything to help it at that point. But we pulled back into the position and the remaining 8 people were there standing on the bow, on the forecastle, right where we had done the hoisting from earlier. And so
ready to go,
right? Yeah. So again, we probably could have changed location somewhere a little bit different, but there was nothing there that told us at that time. We didn't recognize any indicators that we shouldn't do it there.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a dynamic situation in a position that you had never been in before, and it worked last time. Like, why would we?
Exactly.
It's almost like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
Right.
You know, we're in a high-risk situation.
Right.
We know that that was at least doable, and so I don't blame you guys for jumping right back into it. And then, like you said, that the bias of like
you see them,
all the little things like them, they're like, they're ready for this. Maybe they think this is the best. Like, this is just easier than stopping it.
I know we beat this to a dead horse, but like, there's nothing more unattractive than trying to use that mental energy to change.
Right.
Locations. And like you coming out and you're seeing that. Oh, dude! I know. Personal experience, like you go out back to a star case and it's the same thing. It's like, I don't want to have to figure out, because it took me an hour to figure out this before, and it's just
and you know, for some reason we were in this mentality at this point that time was of the essence, right? And it sort of was, because it was getting darker. The weather was roughly the same, but it was becoming more challenging because of the location now of the boat inside the break zone. So the conditions had become more challenging, even though they hadn't really changed all day, you know, for the most part. So we sort of started developing this sense of pressure to get it done and get out of there and get back to the seafood buffet.
Rightfully so.
You're getting even more fatigued, too.
Yeah, right. And I wouldn't say we're rushing at this point. We have a sense of urgency, right? Yeah. Because we are perceiving that the situation is getting worse minute by minute.
Right.
Whether or not it was, it's hard to say, but we were perceiving that at least. And so we were trying to get it done as quickly as possible.
Also, you don't want to do this at night.
No. Okay. Nope, you don't. Certainly not. Nope.
There's an internal part that kind of knows about how much more gas you have left in your tank.
Right.
And you're all kind of working with that. And
Yeah, so this is kind of late afternoon, and it's starting to get dark. You know, Alaska in December, right? So it's starting to get dark probably around 3 or 4 or 5 p.m., something like that.
Yeah.
We start by putting the basket back down on, you know, down on the deck for the first survivor.
Yeah.
And I'm in my mind, I'm sort of hoisting to a 41 footer, just like I've been doing all day, 30 foot hoisting altitude. Why 30 feet? Well, because you don't want to be closer. why not higher? Because you lose sight of a 41 foot at 30 feet in an H60, right? Yeah. So 30 feet was the comfort zone. And I can go lower too on this boat as long as the boat wasn't moving around. And so 30 feet and lower is what I was hoisting to. Did I need otherwise to be at that altitude? No, that's just where it was comfortable. And somebody once said, the more you hoist, typically the lower you get with your hoist, 100%. Right?
Yep.
The more comfortable you are in that close proximity to the boat, the more willing typically a lower altitude is easier than a higher altitude.
Yeah, you just have more references. How comfortable pilots are, you feel comfortable close to the ground.
Gosh, yeah. I love visual references. And
not only that, but your perspective of the boat. So this is such a large ship, right? So if I'm real high above it, I have a hard time perceiving the movement of the boat.
Yep.
If I'm down low, it's more of a, you know, I can sort of superimpose the boat over the horizon and stuff, and I have a better sense of how it's moving. And and so your perception of movement is a lot better for your hoisting area specifically. So I think there's more to it than just being comfortable. It's actually a lot, I think, physically easier to be lower. Other than that, though, I have no reason for being 30 feet over this boat, right? And so we put the basket down on the deck, and everybody just stood around and looked at it.
You're not using trail lines at all?
No, because there was nobody on there. They were just ship crew members, and we didn't know their training or anything like that, right? So we're just doing direct basket deployments. Gotcha. So the basket goes down on the deck, and everybody just looks at it. And I'm holding a hover, you know, the boat's moving and stuff, and I'm just holding a hover trying to keep my spot over the boat as it's moving around and give it about 30 seconds. I could hear Brian Lickfield in the back screaming at the guys, trying to get him to get
the freaking basket, dude.
And so finally I say, abort the hoist. We pull the basket back up and I move off and we start talking about it. We still have Aaron Bean in the aircraft, right? And so I say, Aaron, if we put you in the basket and put you down on the deck, can you start getting these people moving there? He's like, yes, sir.
All right, guys, we're going to pause here real quick. I think this is going to turn out to be a two-parter. So tune in next week for the exciting conclusion to this amazing case.
You don't want to miss it.
We say goodbye, but never leave.